You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to another episode of On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them. My name is Eran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello! You know, Eran, I had several GMs asking me how to create a realistic political landscape in a fantasy setting. Now, I always answer that I see no reason why a political landscape and political relations will be any different in a fantasy setting than it is in the real world, right here. And that has worked fine for me in many, 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 many years of role-playing. However, I am technically not an expert on political relations. So, for today's episode, we have brought in a professional. We have a guest. Introduce yourself, guest.
Hello, I'm Chagai Elkayam Shalem, and I'm a political psychologist and a strategic consultant for political operatives in Israel. Yeah, and I also have a podcast about politics, in Hebrew, sorry. It's called The Spinner Behind the Curtain of Politics. I use it to explain to people how politics actually works, because even in the real world, it's not that clear sometimes.
We highly recommend that you guys go and listen to The Spinner if you speak Hebrew, or at least if you can understand Hebrew, you don't actually need to speak it.
And also, Chagai is an amazing role player.
Yes.
Which gives him the ability to see both sides of our specific conundrum today, which is how to play politics.
Yeah, which is kind of weird for me, because most of the time I spend so much time working on politics that when I get to actual games, I'm like, do we have to?
Yeah.
But then, yeah, I have to, because that's the way I think about the world. So it reflects into my games, because, yeah.
So let's start with the basics. What is politics in generally? Of course, let's not get into super duper details. But what is it and how is it expressed in the game?
Okay, so basically, let's start with what politics is about. And it's basically power struggles that don't necessarily involve actual physical conflict. That means if you actually use armies or weapons, that may be a continuation of politics. You know, Clausewitz said that war is a continuation of politics by other means. But in general, it's a different thing. It's when you try to decide who enforces his will on any sort of system, but we don't resort to actual physical struggles. So basically everything in games which is about a struggle, but not about a physical combat, those things are usually sort of politics in some way or another.
So for our D&D listeners, everything that doesn't involve initiative.
I always talk to people and I explain that politics includes a lot of manipulation. They always dislike politics because it includes manipulation. And then I explain that manipulation is part of life. Like when you ask your neighbor for a cup of sugar or something, that is also manipulation. It's not a very significant manipulation. It doesn't harm anyone, but it's all on the same scale. So all sorts of things are politics. Politics is who will be the new staff member in our faculty and who is going to get the job. And all those things can involve politics in one way or another. But usually when we talk about politics, of course, we talk about public officials and stuff like that.
Yes, we might want to say that we, in this episode, will focus on the grand scheme of things. We're talking about organization, governments, kingdoms, etc., and not how to roll diplomacy and what kind of bonuses you should be getting for your diplomacy role.
Yeah, it's less interesting to discuss what goes on in a specific political interaction. Politics is about the system around many, many interactions.
So suppose I want to create a political structure in my campaign. What would be the fundamental building blocks which I have to think about in order to create a realistic political landscape?
Okay, so we have to start from different people who want different things. If there is no conflict, there is no politics, there is no interesting thing to actually play, of course. We have to find what's the fundamental conflict in the system. So that's first of all, but I think that's what most of us start with anyways. But then we have to make that system actually feel real, which is the part that many of us struggle with, even me when I'm designing a game. There are three things I want to focus on. First of all, let's avoid systems who have clear good and bad sides when we're designing a political system, because if we have clear good and bad sides, every other question is irrelevant many of the times. It's much, much less interesting. It is very interesting to play a game when we have conflict, when there are two good choices or two bad choices. But when one choice is clearly better than another, we have nothing to play with. So that's the first thing I would start with.
I would like to give an example of both sides of this. Like, for example, if someone is working for Sauron, they're bad. The end. There's no, there's nothing to discuss here. And what they want is to destroy us completely. And this can never change. On the other hand, if one group wants to build a bridge because this will allow them to cross to the other side and then there could be some trade, and the other group doesn't want to build a bridge because they want to keep their own land to themselves and make sure that no one can just invade through a bridge, these are two groups and they have two different motivations and things that they want from the world. And now there's some conflict and no one is bad or good.
Also note that in your example, Eran, the conflict is not really about the bridge. The bridge is one example for those two different approaches which are colliding on this specific project.
Sure.
It's important because a lot of time people confuse the two. This is not a debate about building a bridge. The bridge is one example of the bigger debate whether we should keep to ourselves or open trade.
Okay, so that's the first thing. Now, the second thing I think is even more important. I think it's the most important of the first steps in designing a political system. It's that we have to refrain from monolithical sides. So what are monoliths? Basically, when we have, let's say, the king's people and the queen's people and they're in conflict, and the king's side, everyone agrees and everyone works together and there's no inner conflict, and the same thing on the queen's side. That makes for a political system that is very, very boring. As we are recording this, in the United States, there's the Democratic primaries, right? Between different candidates from the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. Now, those are people basically in the same party, but they're in huge conflict with each other, right? So that makes things more interesting. It makes it much more interesting than just the fight between two monolithic parties that have no differences inside them and no conflicts inside them. You have to break apart every side into several different people working together. Like, at the very least, if you have two opposing sides, make sure each one has at least two players, two main sides within it.
If we go to that example again, then the guys that want to build the bridge, one of them want to build the bridge because they want trade, but the other want to build the bridge because they want to invade the other side. Now, they both agree that the bridge must be built, but they might have very different opinions when the dudes from the other side say, no, we don't want to build a bridge, because the invader would say, aha, see, they don't want us there. Let's invade with double the force. And the guys that don't want to build a bridge, again, can have very different, varying opinions within them. Maybe there's a king. The king is xenophobic and doesn't want anyone to go into his land. But maybe most of the people under him just do what he says because he's the king. And their opinion might be something else entirely. And they're just afraid of the king. And they say, yes, sure, yeah, yeah, we don't want anyone from outside because king said.
Yes, exactly. Using those kinds of inner conflicts within each side gives you a lot more things to deal with, to work with as a player. It means that the players can try to break apart the other side and there's more things for them to do. Now, there are a lot of ways to actually build this kind of system, but one way that I can suggest is just by using a grid. Let's say a 2x2 grid. One to build a bridge, doesn't want to build a bridge, wants to go to war, doesn't want to go to war. Now you have two sides, each with a specific inner conflict, and then you can have alliances going several ways. If you want to make it really, really fun to play, make the sides not equal, not like 25% in each of the quadrants, but more or less in each specific quadrant to make the mathematics interesting, to make the considerations more interesting. Another possible grid that you can use, let's say we have people who want to build a bridge, and some of them are friends, very, very good friends, or even allies, or business partners, or whatever, with people from the other side that don't want to build a bridge. And then we can use those personal connections to break apart that system. We see that a lot in, like, in our national politics here in Israel. We always see people who cooperate between parties, and those cooperations actually make it much harder for the parties to be really, really opposed to one another.
And remember that once you have this scheme, this grid, if you will, it's a lot easier for you as a game master to take elements and spin them in new and interesting ways. You are not limited by simply having one side versus the other, but you can have subsets working in interesting ways.
I just want to drive in this point because it's very, very important. I've seen tons of campaigns in the real world fall apart because the first person in the party, like the number one person and the number two person, can't agree on anything, and they have two factions, and those factions don't agree on anything, and then you need to go outside and actually convince voters. But no one will go and do that because they don't want to work with people on the other side. That's such a main thing in every political operative life that you have to include it. And it makes for a lot of interesting drama and a lot of conflict, and it gives players much more things to do. I think this is the most important thing you have to consider. And it's the first thing we all miss when we design political system. We just make two factions, three factions, and we treat each faction as a monolith.
Yes, as a collection of faceless goons that just agree with the ideology and that's it.
Yeah, and I don't blame any one of us when we do that, because that's what we usually see in films and TV and stuff. The Empire had a traitor once in 9 movies, and that was like, whoa. I mean, it was poorly executed, but whoa. And usually they're like, yeah, we all follow the emperor and we have no second thoughts even when he sends us to our deaths.
As a GM, it's easy because I don't need to think about it. These are just goons. They have statistics and they will probably shoot at you. You will shoot back. And that's it. And that's fair. And I think that's fair on the basic level when you just, like, for example, face them in combat. But once things start to escalate, for example, if one of the players approach the captain on the other side and want to talk to them, immediately start thinking about how this captain might disagree with some of the things that they are supposed to agree with, how they are not a part of a monolith, how they are a single person with their own thoughts that might in many ways contribute to this political power, but they're still their own self.
Okay, so that's point number two. Now, point number three. Every politician has an internal conflict within himself or herself. It's part of being in politics. We all think of politics as somewhere where there is no ideology or as a place that is driven by ideology. It depends on whether you like the West Wing or House of Cards, basically. But most politicians have both of these drives inside them. And understanding that makes for much more interesting characters. Politicians and people involved in political systems always have a drive to promote some sort of ideology. Otherwise, they would probably not enter politics. And on the other side, they have a self-interest. And of course, it's not that these two are always in conflict. Because if I have an ideology and I want to promote something, I have to get elected. I have to promote myself. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how much I'm pure ideologically, because I will have no power with which to implement whatever it is that I want. And this conflict is central to politics. Now, the main place where this thing comes up is when you have to make some sort of compromise. And that's the number one thing that politicians need to learn how to do. Make compromises. Know when to give up something you want to gain something else you want. And that means those two axes of politics, ideology versus self-interest, always look for places in which your character can go after more power for themselves or go after some sort of ideological achievement. And that conflict will make the games much more interesting and also will reflect actual politics much better. Okay, so that's point number three. Now, the last point I want to make is always consider the psychology of each political player. I mean, that's something we always need to consider when we have an NPC. We need to consider their motivations and their history and the way their history affects their motivation. But in politics, it's very, very clear a lot of the time that politicians' histories really, really change how they approach various situations. Now, the main example here is Netanyahu here from Israel, which I can talk about because we're doing this podcast in English. And what I know about Netanyahu is that he always needs to win. And when I say win, it's not that he wants his coalition to win. He needs a personal victory. He's really, really concerned that someone from his own side of the political system will try to overthrow him. So he's always concerned about this thing. He's always paranoid. And that makes him take very questionable political moves. The two main examples from the last year, and don't want to get too much into it, but one example is that basically every one of the right-wing politicians in Israel that gained any traction in public opinion, Netanyahu made a special effort to tear down, to send them to ministries with no influence, or to make sure they don't get jobs, or to diss them in the media, or stuff like that. And the second thing he did is in each and every election, and we had several in the past year. Yes. So in each and every one...
Yeah, it's a special year in Israel.
So in each and every one of them, he wanted so much to be the biggest party that he had no problem of attacking parties on his own side, saying, if I'm not the leader of the biggest party, I'm not going to win, I'm not going to be elected. And these things caused one of his allies to not pass the electoral threshold by 1,400 votes. 1,400 votes, which would have made Netanyahu prime minister last May. And because of his obsession with winning, with being the largest party, with making sure not his coalition wins, but he personally wins, because of these issues, psychological issues, let's say, because of these, he lost. So that's a huge thing about politics. Politicians are very, very influenced by their environment, by their history, by their personal defects, and those are reflected in their politics.
So what you're saying is we're all flawed, even when we're kings, maybe especially when we're kings, and this should be taken into account. Again, that's anti-monolithical.
Yeah.
Yeah, and let's take it down again to the game level. We're simply saying, if you have someone leading an organization or a kingdom or anything else, make sure that it doesn't just have the interests of the kingdom, but also his own personal interests and preferences.
Yeah, and he won't make an alliance with that other kingdom because the king of that other kingdom fought with him when they were 12, or... won against him in a race or something like that. That's how things usually work. People work against their political interests because of personal flaws, and that's what makes politics much more interesting. So it can make your game much more interesting.
Let's continue. How can I, as a GM, create an interesting political system and manage it? Because it sounds like a lot. Then give me some tools.
I think the best tool I have ever seen for political systems is Apocalypse World fronts. Mm. Fronts are the best example I know of to simulate real political systems. It's just a lot of different people with different motivations, each working in their own vector, in their own way, and those people come into conflict sometimes. Now, if you plan for 3 or 5 or 6 different parties, each with their own agenda and motivations, and just let them loose on the game world, usually you'll have a good start. You'll need to track every session what's going on with each of those parties, and then you'll have a functioning political system.
So you generally just need to know what they want as a group, how they are trying to achieve it currently, and change that if things change. And the pieces might not be the ones who change it. Maybe a different political group did something behind the scenes that made things different for everyone. And what their capabilities are. Like, for example, the Thieves Guild might, as a political force, might be able to assassinate, while the King's Guard probably can't assassinate. So that will influence how they try to achieve the things that they care for.
But the main difference from regular fronts we use in games is that, in contrast to regular fronts, as we said, sides are not monoliths. That distinction will change the entire influence of the front, because usually when we write a front for a game, we write about the Thieves Guild trying to overthrow the city, and then each NPC of the Thieves Guild will be trying to overthrow the city, right? So here, usually when I create a faction, I don't stop when I've created the faction and its leader. I always write up at least 3 or 4 NPCs. Mm. And when I have all of them and I write to myself what each of them individually wants and what are their conflicts and which one of them sees himself in a leadership position and all sorts of these things, only then do I feel that the political faction is really operational.
Nice.
Another very important aspect is that in political games, we have different themes than in our regular adventuring games. Would you like to elaborate on that, Chagai?
Yeah, what we've said up until now is useful in any game. If you have any sort of political conflict in your game, you can use that. But when you have a game about politics, that politics is the central feature of, there are several themes that are naturally occurring when we're talking about politics. Now, the first theme is paranoia. And paranoia is...
Not the role-playing game, obviously.
Yeah. And paranoia is a natural feature of political systems. Because when you are a politician, you are always worried. You are worried that someone close to you will betray you. You are worried that someone is planning something which you don't know about and will surprise you. You are worried that the polls you look at are not real and you're missing something. You're always worried. And the main thing about this worry is that it's right. It's the it's a good instinct.
It's justified, you say.
Yeah, it's justified. And usually politicians who are not paranoid don't remain in politics for very long because someone betrays them and they lose face and they lose their electorate and they don't think what other people might do to them and they don't think about political maneuvers. Paranoia is central and politicians are always afraid of these things. I've met with a group last week that wanted to protest against their local municipality about something and they asked me, what should we do? What's their next move? And I told them, listen, your council members are terrified of you. They don't know you are 5 people. For them, you may be hundreds of people. You may be holding their entire political future in your hands. And they don't know unless they meet you, unless they test you, unless they follow you for a while. So they will try to appease you. So you need to go on with your protest. And then you have to make sure you get something from them. Choose what your price tag is, ask for it, and a lot of the times politicians will just give it to you because they're terrified of you because they don't know you are 5 people. They don't know how many you are. And that's a huge power that citizens have, and that's something very, very central to political systems. So paranoia.
So in a way, the person on top or the council on top are very much aware that they're not a monolith, that there's not a very big, thick, gigantic stone structure beneath them holding them up. Instead, they see it as a ready to crumble at any minute.
Yeah, I've had a friend who was a consultant for a minor member of one of Israel's parties, and his boss asked him, what's the difference between me and the head of my party? And the consultant said to him, what do you do between meetings? And he said, well, I prepare. I read material and I think about my position and I write things and stuff like that. And he said, okay, that's the difference. The leader of your party, between meetings, he makes 30 phone calls to make sure each and every one of his allies is still with him. And that's what he does all day long, every day. And that guy, no one knew how the hell that guy actually ran for prime minister here in Israel, and that's his secret. He was a very good people's person, always making sure no one betrays him, always making sure people are still with him, with personal phone calls to thousands of people.
Huh. Brilliant. And what's the next theme for Political Game?
Politicians are always concerned about that tension I talked about earlier between ideology and pragmatism, between the need to be a shining beacon of your ideological position with no compromises and the need to actually get things done. And those things are always in conflict. It's very rare that you can just pass your laws and fulfill your ideology and stuff like that with no conflict. It's very, very rare. So politicians always need to give up things. And that's a huge conflict between them and their position. And they always think about it and they always deal with it. And a game about politicians is always about how much you can promote your ideals and how much you will give them up for personal gain. That's the core story of many political stories we've seen. House of Cards, West Wing, Vice, Veep.
Again, taking everything you said into the basic game level, I would argue that one of the best ways to present this in your games is to let the players have some access to information about leaders who perform compromises that are very much against their ideologies. That puts your players in a position of power in relation to political power, as opposed to the regular power that player characters usually have. It can be about that cleric who had to make a deal with the god of darkness in order to get a church in place where they could help other people, etc., etc. It could be something else about someone conspiring with the elves in order to protect their own borders, however, while placing his kingdom in a sort of a bind, shall we say, with the elves. Give each political player some secret, some point in time in which they had to really compromise on their ideologies and their values. I want to continue this line by emphasizing the amount of help players can do in a political game or in a game that finds itself in a political setting. We as players can select ideologies for our characters. And ideally, those ideologies will be ones that already have the backing of organizations inside the game world. This does not only make our character more ingrained in the game world, but also gives our GM a lot of hooks and ways to manipulate the political setting because he knows which side of the political map our characters are affiliated with. So make strong choices about your character. Affiliate with an organization and choose really well what is the ideology that got your character to affiliate with that specific organization. So that later on, the GM could use pragmatism in order to create an interesting conflict inside that specific scenario.
I will say one more thing about creating an ideology for your character, and as a GM, an ideology for different actors or players in the political system. Use things from the real world. Usually not, I don't mean the Democratic and the Republican parties, yeah? But I'm talking about ideologies that have strengths in the real world, that people know from the real world. Because going back even 2,000 years, we've had the Populares and Optimates in ancient Rome, basically left-wing and right-wing, people who are on the side of the commoners and people who are on the side of the aristocrats. And those conflicts repeat in politics for ages. They are a basic part of politics. And when you use these sorts of ideologies in the game, players will have a much stronger emotion towards those ideologies, and that will make for a better game. Of course, every ideology from the real world can have some sort of counterpart in even a fantasy setting, from racism and fascism and communism and all sorts of these things. And use the emotions your players have towards those ideologies to make the game much more interesting.
And then subvert everything when the fascist is revealed to be not part of the monolith, when in fact they have their own thoughts and feelings and personal agendas and etc. etc.
Yep.
I think it's an excellent time to summarize. So, Chagai, if you want to continue on from here and maybe listen to some other stuff or read some other stuff, can you give us like one or two, at most three, examples of things, of resources we can go to?
Okay, let's start with TV shows, which is the go-to thing for most people right nowadays. So you have two huge political TV shows. You have House of Cards, at least the first three seasons, and you have The West Wing. Now, an average of those two shows is a somewhat accurate representation of politics. Each one of them is extreme in its own way, but both of them together can give you an idea of how politics works. The West Wing is a great example of ideology and how ideological people promote their interest in political systems. But it's a bad example because it's all monolithic. Everyone is for the president, and the small conflicts the team has within itself are very, very small and can be easily overcome with 40 minutes of an episode. So it's an accurate representation of some part of politics. On the other hand, House of Cards is very, very cynical and sometimes too cynical. I think in the fourth season, I was very, very angry because it always felt like they had a stack of character sheets for all characters, and every character sheet just said, this character wants power. And that's it. And they had no other motivation. They had no one in that series has any ideology. So it's an inaccurate representation as well. But combining ideas from those two shows can give you some sort of an idea of how political systems work. But if you really want to understand politics, I suggest a ton of reading. First of all, I will suggest every book by Robert Caro. Robert Caro started by writing a huge doorstopper biography of Robert Moses, which was Parks Commissioner of New York State, which doesn't sound like much, but it's an insane book. He was the most powerful person in New York for like 40 years. No one could move him aside. It was amazing. So the biography is also amazing. It's huge. It's 66 hours in audiobook format, but what? It's amazing. And that's his first book. That's Robert Caro's first book. And then he went on to write a biography of Lyndon Johnson, out of which we have four parts, and we're waiting for the fifth. George Martin's got nothing on Robert Caro. And those two biographies are amazing in understanding how power works, and they're also great histories of the U.S. political system. You have to read them. I know it will take you a ton of time, because listening to all of these five books in audiobook format is like watching the entire West Wing twice.
Oh, God.
But it's amazing. And finally, I will recommend a book called The Dictator's Handbook, which is basically a book about how politicians look at political systems as a system in which they always have to invest resources in preserving their power. And that amazing book was also translated into video format by CGP Grey in his amazing video, The Rules for Rulers.
Which is like 12 minutes long, so that's probably where you should begin. There are, of course, links in the show notes for all of this.
Mm-hmm. My hope for this episode is that once you have finished listening to it, you will go to your desks, you will take out a fresh piece of paper, and write down at least two or three organizations for your campaign. And inside each organization, do a grid and have some factions inside that, and just sit back and see the possibilities open before your very eyes.
I would tell you my idea, but my speechwriter didn't come today, and so it will have to wait until the briefing on Monday. And now it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of the war.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our own personal lives. Chagai, how about you begin, since you're our guest? You can talk about any role-playing experience from the past more than 1 week.
So I've started a new campaign about a month ago or 2 months ago, and it's amazing. It's an Invisible Sun campaign.
Oof.
And yeah, and although it's part Invisible Sun, part homebrew, and part my ideas, but you know, that's how every game starts. And the thing is, the players are playing members of a cult, but not like in the Cthulhu cult genre, but in the, we've actually read up a bunch about cults and how they work and how they operate.
Oh, nice.
And we've, yeah, and we've had a mini campaign 2 months ago during a long weekend in which they were oriented into the cult and everyone got a little bit shaken up because of that game. It was pretty hard on everyone because cults are terrible and terrifying. But it's an interesting game because it's about broken people with broken lives that find out there is magic in the world and try to use it to better their lives, but it usually just turns out to make their lives even worse. And it's very, very interesting. And the system we're using, Invisible Sun, is also pretty interesting. It has very, very evocative magic.
And it's pretty unusual in other ways as well. Please explain just a bit what is Invisible Sun, where it comes from, and why it's weird.
Invisible Sun is a game that when you look at it, it feels like it should have designed by Kickstarter written all over it because it comes in a huge black box with tokens and cards and a sculpture of a hand and 2 game boards and cloth maps and regular maps and tokens for like a bar of a place inside the game world which you should hang on a wall or something, and dice and more tokens, if I didn't mention tokens before, and also 4 books and an art book and a notebook. And it's too much. It's insane. I've unboxed the game with a friend of mine, and basically what he said every minute of the unboxing was, Monte Cook is insane. He's insane. We're like opening up another layer, like, he's insane. He's insane. He's clearly insane.
But it did cost, like, it cost hundreds of dollars in the Kickstarter. It's like the premium of premiums of role-playing games.
Yeah, I think it's a tad overpriced. It's a little overpriced, but it's not too much because you do get 4 books and then like another book's worth of magic and magic spells and items and stuff like that in cards. So if you compare it to like D&D, which costs, you know, $150 for all 3 books, and then Invisible Sun costs $250 for the entire package, you know, it's overpriced, but it's not that overpriced. You know, the main thing here is it's a decent game. It has some very weird ideas. And basically, I told you before, and when we met, I got to that game first by wanting to hate read it all. I wanted to read it and make sure it's a terrible game. And then I felt a sinking feeling in my stomach, which is like, oh my God, I'm going to have to buy this. Oh no. And then I bought it and it's pretty decent.
As for me, I just bought today, the day we're recording it, 3 bundles from the Australian Bushfire Relief Bundle in Drive-Thru RPG. They released 8 bundles because there were a lot of people that wanted to participate. All of the money, of course, goes to relief organizations, specifically Red Cross of Australia and the World Wildlife Fund, WWF Australia. And I should note that Uri and I both got items on this list, specifically on the same list, the Fantasy Supplements one. Uri got his Escape from Thalamus Lab adventure. He just released it like a month ago and it's on there. And I got Things That Went Wrong While You Went Away, which has some rules for Dungeon World, but is beyond that part of my free suggestion series. And so obviously I thought I will not buy this bundle because I have 2 things on it. I don't need this bundle. Instead, I looked at some of the other bundles. There's one dedicated to capes and grit and gun smoke, it says. And there's another one that's all about fantasy core and settings. And there's one about modern and urban horror. And there's one about starships and post-humanity. And it turned out that I bought 3 of them, which is a lot of money. It's like $80. We've spent $80 from up to 4 players' publisher account. It's money that we got from selling PDFs of Crystal Heart and stuff like that. That's the money that we spent here. It all goes to charity, so great. We're fine with that. We think that's just fine. But the amazing thing is, I got a lot of good stuff out of it. I've been buying bundles on DriveThruRPG for many, many years, ever since they started doing these big, huge bundles, and they've been doing charity bundles for a long time. So I've seen a lot of things returning, a lot of RPGs that, and very small, minor, tiny little supplements that return again and again. But this time, there's a lot of new stuff, and there's a lot of good stuff. There's actually so much interesting good stuff that I wanted to buy only one charity bundle. I bought three because I really wanted to check all the good stuff. And one of them is the Fantasy Supplements bundle because it had some interesting stuff. So much interesting stuff that I'm going to write a short review of each of them. Well, it's not a review. I'm only casually reading through all of the things. And then I'll post some reviews of the things that seemed interesting. And already there are more than 20 of them on my Facebook page and probably in our Facebook group as well.
Yeah, there are some amazing finds.
I think that in either Fantasy Core or in Modern Urban, for example, there's Spire, which is a big, huge, important role-playing game of indie role-playing game of last year.
Yeah, in Fantasy Core, yeah, and it's a really great game.
And there's Urban Shadows in the whole one, which is sort of like Vampire the Masquerade in PBTA. And
that's one of the best games for modern supernatural politics. So if we're talking about it nice. In this episode, so very, very recommended.
So check it out. It's on DriveThruRPG. And of course, we'll give links in the show notes. I think the links are with an affiliate link, but I don't think it matters because for charity buys, obviously, we won't be getting any of the money, which is fine. Australia needs that money currently. let it go to them. I'll skip the 0.03 cent that we usually get from affiliate links. Although they really help, the affiliate links. They really do help.
Well, in the last week, I did some playtesting for my adventure, and now I'm off to the next stage, which is, you know, editing and layout and all those weird stuff. So much work. It's amazing how much extra work you need to put in to get a quality product rather than just to have, you know, the content of the product itself. It's really exhausting. On the other hand, I also spent a few hours revamping our Patreon page. So if any of you guys find our content useful, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Thank you.
And this is it. That was us. Thank you very much, Hagai, for participating, for being in this episode, for talking about the things that you're good at, you love, and you work at. I assume all three.
And thank you for having me. It was very, very great.
For sure. This was more like an intro to politics, of course, obviously. If you guys at home have more questions, specific questions, specific ideas or concepts or situations that happened in your game and you want us to discuss, send us an email to show@dwarfcast.net and we will reply with an email and maybe with an episode as well, if we deem it worthy. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, search for @dwarfpodcast. And if you want to look for us on our website, where we obviously have all of our past episodes, go to dwarfcast.net. That's it. And now, as usual, we say goodbye in our native language, which in this time is the same language. Lehitraot!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution and non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the shoulders of dwarves.